taping, doing an oral history of Nissen Finkelstein on May 16, 1988. Nissen, I wish you would start this afternoon by telling me a little bit about your early life, where you were born, give us the date, and something about your family.
Well, I was born on June 11, 1925 in Milton, Massachusetts. It's a town just outside of the city of Boston. My parents moved from Milton for a short period in which we lived in Brookline, Massachusetts, also just outside of Boston, and then moved back to Milton. So I spent most of my 25 years that I lived in the Boston area, almost all of it in Milton, and went to school in Milton. Now, as for my parents, they were both born in Boston, and their parents, my grandparents, came over to this country sometime around the Civil War years. My paternal grandfather, the one for whom I'm named, came from Lithuania, from a city called Pren, P-R-E-N, which was outside of Kovna, so he came from a rich Litvak tradition, Lithuanian Jewish tradition. His wife, my paternal grandmother, was from Manchester, England, and I guess it originally entered the United States in New York City. Her name was Levinson, and lived with my grandfather, of course, in Boston all their lives. My other two grandparents, my maternal grandparents, were also born in Europe, came to this country sometime, I think a little later than my paternal grandparents, but again in the late 1860s, I believe, maybe even as late as 1870. And my maternal grandfather was from Poland, and my maternal grandmother was from Germany. In fact, her name was Ruth, and my grandmother's name, maternal grandmother, and Rona and I think that it probably was a family name taken from a German town called Ruth. And my maternal grandfather's name was Kadetsky, K-A-D-E-T-S-K-Y.
And your parents, what occupation did your father have?
My father was a salesman virtually always his life. I guess in his early years, before I was born, he was a credit collector, because he had wonderful stories about going around in a horse and buggy trying to collect delinquent payments and having flat irons thrown at him and being thrown down stairs. But that was only for a short number of years, I guess. And then he became a salesman, always in dry goods. And he traveled in the New England area when my mother and father were first married, and even when my sister and I were young. But all the period when I really was old enough to know what was going on, he sold retail stores, small department stores and the like in the Boston area, ladies' silk hosiery, and later on some men's hosiery.
Did he make a good living?
Well, as you know, all of us have a hard time remembering whether we were middle class, upper middle class, lower middle class, and I guess we always thought of ourselves, I always thought of myself and our family as middle class, whatever that meant. It was good enough so we weren't hungry, mm-hmm. and so we had clothing and a place to live, and my father needed an automobile to do business, of course, and so we always had that. But it was never luxurious, and so I have a feeling we were lower middle income, probably. I always remember having everything I needed, though not everything I wanted, let me put it that way. And I remember my mother and father, may they rest in peace, were all always fairly modest in their expenditures and in their what they would spend on clothes and on furniture and things of that nature. But of course, this was also masked by the fact that those years I was growing up were the years of the Great Depression, and so that didn't help any. They were of modest means, I guess, would be the best way to say.
What influence would you say your parents have had on you?
Well, as I remarked to you, I think when you first asked me about doing this oral history, the things that are important about determining my life, kind of person I am, are fourfold, really, four elements. My mother, my father, my wife, and my identity as a Jew. And so my mother and father were extremely critical and pivotal in determining who I am and what I am. I think the problem we always have in this is that the theme of a play or the theme of a book is usually apparent from early in the book and from the reviews you read of it, of the book or the play, but the theme of a life only becomes apparent to us when we're well into it or maybe on the way out of it. And things that we thought were important in earlier years come to assume very low levels of significance later. And so I can say at this point clearly that they were two of the four most important things in my life. And if you'd like, I can tell you why.
Yes, I would.
My father, of blessed memory, was never, as I indicated, a wealthy man. He was never what you would call a worldly success. He was always life pretty much in the same job of a salesman. But he was a remarkable man in so many ways, and there's so much that I learned from him that I didn't realize I'd learn until many years later. In fact, some of it till after he had died. He died in 1971. And what did I learn from him? I learned really not by lectures he gave or by written notes or anything, but by what he did, by the way he acted, learned what it was to be a husband, what it was to be a father, what it was to be a member of a family, member of a community. There are things about him that have kept coming back so strongly over the years that I have thought of when certain questions came up, certain decisions I had to make of which way to go and on one thing or another, that made me realize what a tremendous influence he had in setting that pattern of what I guess is best described by the Yiddish word menschlichkeit. It's being, I guess, another the source of, as they say in Pirkei Avot, where there are no men, be a man. In that sense, he was a real man, a real mensch.
So that had a significant influence.
Oh, a tremendous influence. Just to give one example, one or two examples maybe even. He never had a night out with the boys. His greatest pleasure in life was being with my mother and with my sister and me. He never was in bowling leagues. He never, when he had to go to meetings without her, it was really always a burden. And he never did anything socially without her. And that his whole focus of effort and whole focus of concentration was on his family, and it moved out from there and in a traditional Jewish way where, you know, we're taught that we should first be responsible to for ourselves and then for our immediate family and then for our greater family and then for the community and move outward. And he really was that way. I remember as a boy that whenever there was a crisis in either his family or my mother's family, any sort of crisis, you know, medical crisis, financial crisis, any kind of a problem or a crisis, he was always the one that they called, and he was always ready to go leap into the fray and do what had to be done. Usually something unpleasant. They usually called him when there was something unpleasant to be done. He did the same thing in the community when, I remember he was the main drive in starting the first synagogue in the town of Milton. And it was started and built under conditions of anti-Semitism in the late 30s, early 1940s that we don't know today. And I can remember so well, that was my freshman year at Harvard, coming home to be at a town meeting. Milton was run on the town meeting system, the old New England way of running a town, at which the question came up of granting zoning approval for building this new synagogue, and which there were all sorts of thinly veiled and even not so thinly veiled anti-Semitic remarks. And he stood before all these people, many of whom, if not most of whom, were against the project, and calmly and gentlemanly but firmly and with great dignity answered the questions and eventually obtained the zoning and went ahead and the synagogue was built. I think he was president for the first maybe 6 years of it.
Yeah, well that's a wonderful role model for you.
Oh, he certainly was.
Yes.
He was a man that I will, and I say this not in false modesty, but one I will never equal.
What kind of Jewish education did you get, and as much as this was an important part of his life?
Yes, and well, an interesting twist of fate led to my receiving what I think was a very good Jewish education. My father was very committed on the religious side of Judaism. My mother more on the Zionist side, and when, if you ask me about her, maybe I'll get into this, but she was a very ardent member of Hadassah back in the years when it wasn't popular to be a member of Hadassah. But both of them wanted me to have a good Jewish education, and there was no synagogue up, obviously, when I was a kid, because, as I explained, the first one was built at the time I was in college, and we used to go to a synagogue that was a fair distance from the place we lived. And so the problem was how to get a good Jewish education, not only for preparation for bar mitzvah, but to get more than that. And this was in the 30s, in the midst of the Depression, because you can see I was born in 1925, I said, by the time I was 8, 9 years old, it was 1933, 1934 was really a terrible time. And my father insisted on getting a teacher, a rather wonderful man by the name of Hyman Corin, later became assistant to Abram Sacker when he started Brandeis University. But Hy Corin was then an assistant professor, a young assistant professor, or associate professor of sociology at Boston University. And he was a very knowledgeable man in Judaica, a Litvak, with a much more emphasis on the intellectual side of things than on the religious side, but a wonderful tutor. And my father brought him in as a tutor for me. I remember it was Tuesdays and Thursdays, twice a week. And he charged the exorbitant amount of $1 each time, which in the 30s was a lot of money. And I think it was one of the early indications to me of how important my family felt Jewish education was, because if they would spend $1 each time, twice a week, to do this, this had to be important, because we're talking about a time when a loaf of bread was 10 cents.
Mm.
And that was the source of my Jewish education. I started 8 or 9, and really kept on with him. I wanted to keep on after the bar mitzvah, and my father encouraged me to do it, my mother too, and so I kept on really until I entered Harvard.
What was, did your sister get a Jewish education?
Yes, but of a lesser intensity. There was a program at a community school, which was about 5 miles away from the house. It had to be driven to, had to take what were in those days streetcars in Boston. I had to walk, I think it was about a mile to Mattapan Square and then take the streetcar there. And she used to do that. My dad was a driver. And that was the source of her education. But unfortunately, in those days, the attitude was that women did not need the intensity of education
right.
that men did. And so hers was a general Jewish education that I suspect, however, was quite comparable to what
women were getting other places.
Well, not only that, I was going to be even a little stronger, and I'm trying to think of a tactful way to say it, quite comparable to that which is taught in the synagogues today.
Mm.
But the advantage of the one-on-one tutorial that I had, which was just, I didn't realize it then, but in retrospect was
yeah.
a fantastic opportunity that I had this for, what, about 7 or 8 years that she didn't have.
What about your secular education?
That was at the Milton Public Schools, which, again, as I look back at them in the perspective of what I see now in the school systems around us, was quite good. It was a classical, what I call English-oriented college education program. What I mean by English-oriented is a tremendous amount of composition, tremendous amount of memorization. We had, I remember it was an elective I took, a course in declamation. I don't think probably people today even know what declamation was, but is. But we used to declaim on subjects, and there was a great emphasis in that school system, in the college preparatory side of it anyway, in learning to speak, to write, tremendous amount of reading, as I said, and memorization, and then a classic emphasis on mathematics, Latin, which I had, 4 years of Latin, French, history, a significant amount of history. It was what the good public schools used to do back in those days, and particularly in the Boston area. I think while Milton was nothing of the caliber of Boston Latin School, Boston Latin School did set a pattern for the better schools in the Boston area.
When did you go to the Boston Latin School?
I never did.
Oh, you did?
No, I never did.
No.
And Boston Latin was really far superior to anything in the Boston area.
And then from Milton, you had a scholarship to Harvard?
Yes, that's, in fact, that's sort of an amusing thing. From the time I was, maybe 10 years old, it was the conclusion of all the family, my mother's family, my father's family, all the aunts and uncles, that my mother and father was, that I was going to go to Harvard. Of course, nobody in the family had ever gone to Harvard, and my mother and father hadn't gone to college, and who would think of college in those days? It was enough to really get by and make a living. But they, somehow, everybody's concluded I was going to go to Harvard. And because I did well in school, I did have a record. My father was always, mother was very proud of, I always had all A's. And everybody felt that I was going to go to Harvard. And Milton did send a fair sprinkling, perhaps 2, 3, 4 graduates each year to Harvard. But nobody ever really had any funds to do it with, and so the hurdle of getting into Harvard was sort of dismissed as, well, you know, somehow I would get into it, and the hurdle of how I would get through it economically, I just accepted that I would have to win scholarships and that I would have to work in order to pay for room and board if I was going to stay there. And the remarkable thing is that everything happened
as planned.
As planned. Each year I have to win a scholarship. And if you think of how upset kids get now today, it's really hard for me to remember back. But I don't remember being very upset, but I remember every year I'd look through the scholarship catalog at Harvard and see which ones I would apply for, because I knew that if I didn't win a scholarship for the succeeding year, I'd be out. And in addition to that, I worked in various jobs, and some of them not so pleasant. I worked in a foundry, for example, in part. I did a florist truck, did all sorts of things to...
While you were at Harvard.
To make the money to get through. But I don't look back on this as a bad time.
Mm-hmm. What was your major?
I majored in physics and minored in philosophy, which today seems strange, but at Harvard then wasn't strange at all.
Mm-hmm. And then you went on from Harvard, you went to MIT?
MIT. And there was a year in between there that was tied up in World War Number Two, what people of my generation call the war, in which I did worked in the Navy radar program, the Navy radar.
And then you went to MIT and got a PhD in
physics with a minor in electrical engineering.
Did you work while you were at MIT also?
Oh, yes. That was sort of have to be assumed. I had teaching fellowships part of the time. A teaching fellowship in those days paid $70 a month plus all your tuition and fees. So the $70 a month was to live on, believe it or not, which was a very good way to lose weight.
Yeah.
And I also was at a later point a research assistant, which paid a little more. I forget how much. I think it might have been $110 a month. And then a research associate, which was really quite liberal, $140, $150 a month. And I also graded papers and did other odds and ends there. But that was easier than the making of funds at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
It was easier to find jobs.
Work once you were in graduate school.
Yes, related to your
work. Right. And when you finished there, then you were ready for your for a job.
Uh-huh.
So what I'd like you to do now is to begin with the jobs that you had and carry through to where you are today in terms of where you went from place to place.
It's really not very, very important, but... if you'd like. Can I digress for a second on this? Because really, these things which I worked so very hard to get through and to obtain, like the education at Harvard, education at MIT, various jobs that I'll run through quickly, the presidencies of companies and the various other things that sound so impressive and was so impressive to me at the time, and that I worked so very hard to get. As I look back at them in retrospect, not just now, but really even 10 years ago, were, how can I put it, they're all that is really like tinsel, like little, these little shiny pieces of paper that glitter and catch your eye, but when you get close to them, you see that all they are thin little strips of shiny paper, and you can take a whole wall of it and crush it together, and it makes just a little ball of almost nothingness. But those things really, that I worked tremendously hard to get and to obtain and to reach the top on, really in the perspective of a lifetime, meaningless. And I think I started to say something at the beginning of this interview that I think of now, that in contrast with a book or a movie where we know the theme when we start because of the reviews we read, in a lifetime you really don't see what's important until you get well into it, and as I indicated, even toward the end of it, because they're really the least important things about my life. And I say this not to be not to be self-effacing or put on a pose of false modesty or anything like that, but because they really are important. And I think one of the tragedies of our society today is that we fight and work so hard to get these things that have so little meaning. But having given that preamble that it doesn't all amount to more than a little ball of crushed up tinsel.
But one part in your life, it was important.
Oh, it was tremendously meaningful.
Yes, and so, and that's why I want to go back to that part just to bring us to where you are today.
It was tremendously meaningful, embarrassingly so. All right, let's go through it. When I got to the end of my PhD work, I had been doted upon, reasons I'm not sure I really understand, by a wonderful man who was the Dean of Science at MIT, George Harrison, who took a liking to me and was my sponsor in so many things. And when he asked me what I wanted to do next, I said I wanted to spend the rest of my life teaching and doing research. He said, well, if you're going to spend the rest of your life teaching and doing research, I want to stay there at MIT and do it. I'll go to another university. He said, if you're going to do that, you ought to spend at least a year in industry. And I remember arguing with him so vociferously I didn't want to go into industry, that industry was a, if this is a tape that may be heard by younger people, I can't use the word that I used with him. But
yes, you can. You definitely can.
I can. Well, then I will tell you. I told him that the industry was a whorehouse, and I really felt when I finally did go into a company, because he pushed me so hard to do it, that I really felt as if I was going from a convent into a bordello, really. But George Harrison, whom I had great confidence in and was very fond of and looked up to so much, as only somebody who's been a lowly graduate student can look up to, not only a professor, not only a department head, but the dean of science of the whole of MIT, I did, of course, what he said I should do. And he said, well, what sort of industry would you like to go to? What part of the country? And I said, I don't want to go anywhere. And so if you want me to go, you tell me where, and I'll go there. So it turned out he had a relationship of some sort. He was either on the board of Bausch & Lomb, the optical scientific company in Rochester, New York, or was a consultant to them, or both. And so through him, I was hired as a research physicist at Bausch & Lomb. And this was in 1950. I started there in March of 1950. Between the time I received my PhD and then, I received the PhD in 49, I taught. In fact, while I was working for the PhD, I taught, and that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. But I went to Rochester, New York, and I think it was March 1950, and was a research physicist at Bausch & Lomb. What I didn't realize at the time was that I was that first generation of Jewish scientists that broke the religion bar, if you will, in American industry. I found I was the only Jew in Bausch & Lomb, which, in addition to everything else, had a reputation for having collaborated with the Germans in the First World War, and maybe even in the second, and it was supposed to be anti-Semitic, which I never experienced, but I was certainly the first and only Jew in Bausch & Lomb. And it was true, of course, at that time, companies like Monsanto, like DuPont, and Bell Telephone, none of these places had Jews until after the Second World War. I guess they needed good technical people enough so they couldn't afford the luxury of anti-Semitism. So the doors were opened, and we were the first, those of us who went to these places around 1950, were the first Jews to get into these companies. So that's where I went, and it was important, very important to me, not because of Bausch and Lomb, though I learned a little there too, but because it was in Rochester, New York that I met Rona, my wife, and we met, I think, only about a month or so after I arrived to report for work, and we were engaged. We met, I think, in April of 1950. We were engaged in June. We were married in September.
So that was, it was serendipitous that you...
Well, I won't call it serendipitous. I think it was a great blessing. The four great blessings in my life have been my mother, my father, my wife, and my being a Jew. And they're blessings that, as I grow older, I more and more wonder at my merit in receiving. And what did I, what was my zechut, what was my merit in receiving these blessings?
Well, when you, how long did you stay at Bausch and Lomb?
Well, I stayed there, let's see, till 1959, and I found not only did I not want to leave immediately, but I even enjoyed it. And not only did I enjoy doing industrial research, but horror of horrors, I became interested in management, and I ended up responsible for the research and engineering in Bausch and Lomb in about 1956. I think, something like that. I guess I was 31 years old at the time.
And so you when you left, you decided, though, to leave Bausch & Lomb.
Yes. Incidentally, another exciting thing during that period was along the way, I had responsibility for a program called CinemaScope. 20th Century Fox wanted to develop a wide-angle screen presentation for motion pictures, and it was that, that particular one was known as CinemaScope, which spread the picture out on a very wide screen and introduced a wonderful, what for those days was a wonderful stereophonic sound system. And they came to Bausch & Lomb with essentially a blank check. I remember seeing the blank check in the president's office when Spiros Skouras, the then chairman of 20th Century Fox, came in with a blank check, put it down on the table of the president of Bausch & Lomb and said, you fill in the amount, we want you to develop this this complete optical system for something called CinemaScope. In fact, I remember, just as a digression, an amusing incident, Spiros Skouras was a Greek, you know, he was a very strong-willed man, and he wrote down this word, CinemaScope. And he wrote it in script continuously, not as two words, but there was a capital C and a capital S in it. And still being a somewhat cocky Harvard graduate at heart, and Bostonian at heart, because I was in charge of research and engineering by that point, I said, Mr. Skouras, I note you have a capital S. Is that two words? He said, no, it's one word. And I said, well, how can you have a capital letter in the middle of the word? And he said, with this heavy Greek accent, he said, look, big shot, if I want a capital letter in the middle of the word, I'll have a capital letter in the middle of the word. And we became good friends, and he always called me big shot after that. It was not a B, it was a P. But that was very exciting, because it gave me the chance to go in and out of Hollywood. And that was a whole new experience for me, because I was involved in all the equipment we made for them to shoot some of these early folk pictures, like Marilyn Monroe's How to Marry a Millionaire, and The Robe. I remember one about the life of Jesus.
And they were using that film that you had been...
Well, we didn't develop the film. It was just regular film, but we developed all the optics. Uh-huh. We developed the camera lenses and the projection lenses and all the special effects lenses for this wide-angle screen, and it was an exciting thing for someone mostly from the academic world of Harvard and MIT to get out into what was, even then in the 50s, the still very romantic
life of Hollywood.
Life of the 20th Century Fox lot, which was a huge city in itself. It exists no more now.
Well, and then you took to industry, and
in a way that I would have considered completely shameless and despicable not too many years before.
And as you would even later, but meanwhile.
Yes, as I do now.
But meanwhile, you were on the road to success, and what was your next venture? And why did you leave Bachelor?
Well, as often happens in the rough jungle of the corporate world, I got into disagreements with some of the top management about where to go. Some of them rather interesting. One of them was that I felt that the future of the optical industry would require making ties to produce in Japan or some other place of low cost. And at that time, which was after all only a decade after the end of the Second World War, this was just something that was explosive as a concept. And I think I would be proved right by what happened later, because all the binoculars and other consumer items that Bausch & Lomb made, of course, are now Japanese made. But there were some differences in approach concerning technical directions and developments of the business. And also, Bausch & Lomb was a very conservative company, and I was introduced to an opportunity to get into what was at that time the most exciting company you could imagine, a company called General Dynamics, which had recently been formed. And there was an article in Fortune magazine called General Dynamics versus the USSR, sort of a naive thing as we look at it now, but at that point, General Dynamics was making the Atlas missile and was making the B-58. It was making virtually all the major armament systems that were protecting the country vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And this rather dewy-eyed article in Fortune magazine caught my eye, and it was at about that time that a headhunter, one of these executive search people, came to me and said there was an interest at top management level in General Dynamics to get me to come there. And so I went to New York and met with Frank Pace, who was the boy wonder, who he was, I think, director of the Federal Budget Bureau of the Budget when he was 28, and Secretary of the Army when he was something like 32, 33. At that point, he was chairman of the board of General Dynamics, which made submarines at the Electric Boat Division and missiles out at Convair and commercial aircraft at Convair and all sorts of other military and civilian hardware. And as a result of that, I ended up going in 1959 to General Dynamics as vice president for, well, originally director of research in the electronics division, and then vice president of research, and then vice president of research and engineering, and then for a period ran the division, the electronics division, which was about half in Rochester and about half in San Diego.
And so you were in Rochester.
Still in Rochester, though a lot of time in an airplane on the way back and forth from San Diego and New York.
And did you find that satisfying?
Yes, in its time, yes, it was very exciting. It was very different. General Dynamics was a very different company from Bausch & Lomb. Bausch & Lomb was a very conservative company. At the time I was there, it was already over 100 years old. Can you imagine that? And General Dynamics was brand new.